A great deal of emotion and events have marked the near-neighbour relationship between Australia and PNG over the years, as you know. Certainly this week saw some pretty surprising developments. Australian and PNG ministers met in the resort town of Mandung for the 25th annual ministerial forum. It included our Foreign Affairs Minister Julie Bishop and Immigration Minister Peter Dutton. In a move said to have surprised our ministers, PNG formally asked Australia to directly fund its health and education spending, instead of funnelling our aid through contractors on narrowly focused programs, as happens now. Now, what will come of this request is uncertain, but what is clear, and that request is eloquent testimony, is that PNG is struggling. We're to hear now some very personal observations from an Australian who returned recently to the PNG Highlands after a 25-year hiatus, in search of what he imagined would be plentiful good news, but who saw that hope disappear as he reconnected with old friends.
Oh, Joe, this is sad.
Yeah.
Hey? Yeah. I filmed you standing right here. Yeah. I remember, man, that great, you know, 5 tonnes of cherry going in. You remember? Yeah, because I remember this was an absolute hive of activity.
Yeah, well, I remember all this receiving vats was all full all the time.
Yeah,
during the coffee season. After how many years? 25 years.
Yeah.
And all gone bush now.
And that's from Bob Connolly's piece he did for Foreign Correspondent last year. And he wrote very interestingly just earlier this month on his experience. He's one of Australia's finest filmmakers. Think Rats in the Ranks, Mrs. Carey's Concert. He first went to PNG with his partner Robin Anderson in the early 1980s, returning in the late 80s and early 90s to make a classic documentary trilogy, First Contact, Joe Lay's Neighbours and Black Harvest. I'll let him take up the story of why it's been so long returning and why it was sad. Bob, a very big welcome.
Thank you.
Can you tell us why you didn't go back for so long?
Well, it was mainly security, to be perfectly honest. In 1990, when we were filming Black Harvest, the tribe that we were making the film about got caught up in a big war, a very nasty war. In fact, probably the biggest war in post-war history in the Highlands in this particular region. It went on for 10 years. There were hundreds killed. But in 1990, although we had worked strenuously to establish our neutrality in the fighting, ultimately events overtook us. And I learned that I was going to be targeted.
Not Robin or your daughter, but you.
No, yeah, me, and which concentrates the mind, as they say. And as it happened, we were about 3 or 4 weeks away from finishing. We had evacuated from the plantation, Joe Lay's plantation, where you heard that little piece then, and we were holed up in the hills above Mount Hagen. But even that became a bit insecure for us. And so when we sort of finished our translations, we had to leave. And I wasn't really confident going back, because you have to understand that, I mean, all through that year there were assassinations going on all over the place, and it wasn't uncommon for people to be standing in a queue at the Westpac branch and suddenly have an axe in there. You know, I mean, it was just
really,
it was just like that. It descended into just an extremely dangerous situation.
And even though you hadn't been back in all this time, you write in this piece in the Financial Reviews magazine about how the place never lets you go. The memories linger in the blood like malaria.
It's true.
Can you just give us a feeling why?
I think it's the people. They're just amazing people. They're just so, I mean, where we were, I mean, we spent very little time in Port Moresby, which is frankly a hole. But out in the Highlands, living among the people in a tribal society, it's just the most extraordinary thing. I mean, they live, everything is lived on the edge, right? They are their own police force. They are their own army, you know, these tribes. And I don't know, there's just something about the openness of the people.
Is it beautiful?
Oh, well, the Highlands, 5,000 feet up above sea level, you know, in the Western Highlands. I mean, the Nebelia, where we spent most of our time, is about 35 kilometres from Mount Hagen. And, I mean, it's just beautiful. Yeah, apart from being beautiful, the climate is phenomenal. And when you get off the plane after spending the requisite amount of days in Port Moresby, you know, which is like a sauna, and is sort of brash and harsh and garish and so on. And then you sort of go out to the Highlands. I mean, as you go over those rushing clear streams, you know, and you breathe that beautiful mountain air, I mean, it's just such a tonic.
So you thought you were going back. You must just very quickly tell us why you went, what got you over your fears and you got back. And, of course, you thought you were heading to a good news story, but it wasn't so.
I got an email around January or February of last year from the son of our interpreter. His name was Thomas Time. He was one of the very few Kaurna who'd been educated in 1990 and had a high school education. And he was translating our talk place, our Timbuka language. We were fluent in Pidgin, but a lot of the time the people, of course, speak to each other in their own talk place. And so he was translating that. And his son emailed me. I think he must have seen a copy of Black Harvest or something like that. He said, oh, look, my name is so-and-so. I'd love to meet you. And I've heard so much about you from my father. I'm a university graduate now. And I've got a good job working for a politician. And there's another girl, a Kaurna girl, who's graduated as well in economics. And everything's very peaceful. The war's been over for 15, 16 years. It went on for 10 years, by the way, 10 years. And I thought, oh, this sounds all right. And so I have an old friend of mine, Stephen Dupont, who's a wonderful photographer. We had sort of teamed up before to do stuff. And I put the suggestion to him, let's go back, you know, and we did.
And so what did you find?
Well, the first thing I found was that the two university graduates were working in Port Moresby. They weren't out, you know, in the village. And the next thing I found was that during those 10 years, no Kaurna child went to school. Now, there are 800 people in the tribe. That's probably 200 or 300 children, a whole cohort, a whole generation of illiterates in those 10 years. And then I found out, you know, that there wasn't a lot of, well, I mainly found, when, then I went back up there, right, and I went out to the, I made contact with Joe Lay was the central character in Black Harvest.
He's now 77, isn't he?
77, yeah, and he's a mixed race guy who took us out to the plantation and I spent probably 10 days there and, yeah, I was profoundly depressed because it was as though the place was paralysed. I mean, the two. It's no time to go into the details of the story about the fact that the central issue of these two plantations, both of which were basic coffee plantations, both of which Joe had his own, and he had become very wealthy. This mixed race son of the first explorer to go in there, he'd become very wealthy with growing his coffee through the 70s. And by the time we got there, mid-80s, and he'd bought the plantation land from the tribe that lived all around him. And so there was this terrific or extraordinary disparity of wealth between Joe, the wealthy sort of Western-oriented mixed-race millionaire, and the tribal people who were still subsistence farmers. And so to, in a way, cover his tracks, he formed a partnership with one of the tribal leaders, Popina, to develop a new plantation which the Kaurna would share the wealth in. And that's why we went back in 1990 to see what they were going to do with the money. Instead of which two things happened. The international price of coffee collapsed and the Kaurna got caught up in this colossal tribal fight. And there, 25 years after, Kalgam, the joint plantation, was just a complete write-off. It had reverted back to jungle. Well, when you say walked away, they still live all around it. I mean, there are these 800 or 900.
They walked away from capitalism.
Yeah, they did. Well, it's sort of, you know, they got a lesson about the downside of capitalism. They also got a lesson about the downside of unbridled tribalism as well, you know, because these two catastrophes together combined to destroy, in a way, their whole opportunity to join the modern world of education and money, and what would that give them? Money to travel, more and more kids getting educated, and so on. And to me, that was, I'm not prepared to say it was symbolic of all of Papua New Guinea.
No.
I'm just looking at this one specific area, And I don't want to, you know, draw long conclusions about it, but yeah, it left me profoundly depressed. Doubly so when I found out that they actually, with Australian aid money, managed to build a primary school in the tribal land, staffed by this teacher who was also a graduate. The two graduates I told you about earlier and this guy had both, their parents had got somehow got them away from the valley during the 10 years of warfare. And so they were able to complete a university education. The school teacher came back to staff this school, to run the school, but he hasn't been paid in 3 years. And the only reason he's able to stay there is because, and this is one of the great saving graces, and I will generalise about it in terms of the rest of Papua New Guinea, 85% of Papua New Guineans are self-sufficient in food and shelter. Now, that is a colossal advantage in a country that's finding it very difficult to enter the modern world, because when the push comes to a shove, they can always fall back on what sustains them.
They're not like some of the drought-ridden parts of that we're reading about right now in South Sudan.
Yeah.
Bob, look, this is just, look, really, you do tell a wonderful story, but I'm going to direct people to the Australian Financial Review of Friday, the 3rd, I think it was, when it was, I saw the particular essay, and I think people will really get a lot from it. Thank you very much indeed, and Foreign Correspondent, of course, as well, which you can go back and stream. Thank you for joining us, Bob.
A pleasure.